this impression that we have is completely wrong. The fact is that cooking dinner and the family gathering is a modern, contemporary thing like the iPhone.
Welcome to Everyday Abundance, the podcast that explores the hidden histories behind everyday activities and technologies you didn't even know were technologies. Hi, I'm Virginia Postrel.
Hi, I'm Charles C. Mann. In this episode, we're going to talk about what seems like a timeless activity, cooking dinner. For most of us, the idea of the Paleolithic era is pretty much exemplified in old black and white TV shows, right? Where Cro-Magnons like Lucille Ball and Dick Van Dyke and Jackie Gleason, Audra Medjuz are always, you know, at the dining room table with a kitchen off here, and the women are cooking dinner and the guys are doing whatever the guys do. And this seems like something that has always existed. And is, in fact, if you're really old like us and have the idea of the ancient times, not black and white TV, but black and white movies. And it's the same thing, right? That this has happened forever and ever since humans began, that there is, you know, preparing dinner and they bring it to the table and the whole family would eat together. And there's now even a kind of a minor moral panic that families aren't eating together as the way they've always done. So we're going to talk about this because this impression that we have is completely wrong. The fact is that cooking dinner and the family gathering is a modern, contemporary thing like the iPhone. Not quite as new as the iPhone, but, you know, in that same category when you think about the long span of human history. So first, let's get something out of the way. What is cooking for?
Right. So we have
why do we cook?
Mostly we're gonna talk about where you cook, but before we get there, we need to talk about why you cook.
I mean, it seems kind of important, right?
Yeah.
Why do people do this? Okay, so the basic idea of cooking is to take heat energy and put it into food. And people have been doing this for a very long time. Now, I am sort of saying this in a defensive crouch. And the reason is that this gets close to something that people feel very strongly about, a small number of people feel very strongly and vocal about, which is the Paleolithic diet.
Right.
We are not advocating the Paleolithic. We are not talking about that. We are talking about something entirely different, which is the diet during the Paleolithic. The basic idea is that if you're a carnivore and you eat raw meat, you have, you know, as you have in the picture in your head, you have big teeth and strong jaws like a tiger. And this is less well known, you have a very slow digestive system. So dogs have, you know, these giant jaws and these big sharp teeth, but it also takes, you know, when the food goes down there, they hold their in their stomach for like up to 4 hours so that the enzymes and so forth in their digestive system can attack this raw meat, which is hard to digest. Similarly, cats, which are, you know, after all, you know, these sort of tiny tigers, the food stays in their bodies for up to 6 hours. People, by contrast, are just terrible carnivores. We have these, you know, namby-pamby jaws and these, you know, small, not very sharp teeth. And we also have very fast digestion. So for meat, what cooking does is it pre-digests the food and allows us to extract more nutrients from it. Vegetables, so the facts are even more sort of striking. Vegetables, you know, you're eating mainly for the starches and cellulose, and these are long chain-like molecules that are quite hard for the body to digest. And to make them, you know, what they call bioavailable, we have to snip them into smaller pieces that are called sugars. And sugars are a whole bunch of different compounds that end in -ose. So fructose, sucrose, you know, lactose. That's what our body can deal with. And the result of the fact that this is very hard for animals to digest, you see from grazing animals, which, you know, if you look at a cow, that cow more than likely is sitting there, you know, with its nose in the grass, munching. The same thing for horses or bison or any number of grazing animals. And a lot of them, the ruminants, had these multiple stomachs where different forms of digestion are trying to hack away at these long chain molecules. And it takes them forever to digest food. So horses take about 48 hours to digest grass, and they do a terrible job of it. I had to clean up after my sister's horses, and as a result, I had much opportunity to study horse poop, and there is a lot of grass in horse poop. Neighbors had cows. Cow patties have so much grass in them that they're literally used as fuel, and the same thing's true for bison and so forth. So cooking is a very big deal because it breaks down these starches and celluloses into the sugars much faster. And so the earliest evidence we have of roasting vegetables comes from archaeologists examining ashes in South Africa, and it's about 170,000 years ago people were roasting it. We don't really know that they're roasting tubers at that point, and it's probable they were roasting things, you know, well before that.
So how were they doing it?
So this is a really good question. I mean, one thing is they put them on sticks.
Okay,
and roast it.
Like
roasting marshmallows. And the evidence for that would, you know, the sticks would burn off. So there's right. So we don't really know that they were doing that,
right.
But it seems they would have to be awfully dumb not to do that. We'd like to imagine. Yeah.
Right.
But we do have evidence that they start using indirect various, you know, where you heat up a bunch of stones and then you place the food on the stones, and that has the virtue of not getting it covered in ash and smoke and so forth. And that seems to have been like at least 200,000 years ago. But again, this is arrangements of stones. It's easy for archaeologists to fool themselves. And you also have natural means of doing this. One is if you take the many, many stomachs of ruminant animals, you can use them as natural vessels and cook them at the same time that you cook the food. And this survives in the modern era in the form of haggis, which is this Scottish dish that is, you know, legendarily awful, right? I've actually had it, and it's not that bad.
It sounds bad. I think it's more it sounds bad because it involves a stomach.
A stomach, and you put unattractive things in the stomach and cook it up and then chop it up and serve it. And this is like this thing that, you know, every culture has like something. Is it the Danish that have lutefisk that is, awful for non-members of the culture, like smelly types of tofu or super strong cheese and so forth. And the haggis is in that category. And then you end up with things like pottery.
Okay,
and
so that's the great leap forward.
That's a huge leap forward. And the earliest evidence we have that is in Asia, 20,000 years or so ago. And pottery just lets you, put a bunch of water and stuff in the fire and cook.
It's great for archaeology. Just also because it lasts.
It lasts, right. So this is cooking. This is cooking and why we cook, but it's not making dinner.
And it's not, and it's being done in the general sort of outside in a fire.
Right. It's not being done in a kitchen.
It's being done maybe communally.
Yeah.
Right.
And so people do eat together. I mean, they have like feasts and so forth. But this whole idea of the family dinner, there's very little evidence of it existing. And again, it's a zillion different cultures. Am I saying that no culture anywhere ever had a tradition of family dinners and so forth? No, we just don't know that. But it was not a common, ordinary thing for people to do. It was not a traditional activity that was sort of universal like the way we imagine it. And so, we have evidence of feasts from the Natufians, who are some of the earliest people in the Middle East, in the Jordan Valley, 12,000 years ago. There's pretty clear archaeological evidence of a whole bunch, the whole tribe, so to speak, gathering together for some possibly religious purpose. And so there's this idea of commensality or commensal stuff where people are eating together. But that's, again, different from the kitchen.
And there are many cultures you would have some religious festival.
Right.
You would sacrifice some animals to the deity. And the people would eat a lot of some of it would be burned for a burnt offering, but you would also, people would eat that together, the lamb or
the cow. And this continues right into the historical record. You have people like the Blackfeet there'd be hundreds of people gathered on these sort of communal buffalo hunts, and they have these buffalo jumps, and they would drive the buffalo over the bumps and then kill them. And then they would have this 3-day long feast where everybody would just eat a whole lot of food.
Right.
But that's, again, that's really cool. It's on, and there's lots of, for the project area, I read a lot of records of Europeans being invited along. They all had a great time, but it was not cooking dinner in a kitchen. Yeah.
Right. So when people ate together, so we've kind of covered why cook.
Yeah.
And some idea of where do people cook?
Right. So this is a surprisingly, obvious but also surprising answer is they cook sort of outside. Right. You know, for most of human history, you have a fire and you have, you know, the fire pit or whatever, and people are cooking outside. And then people just come and eat whenever they want. You know, you're hungry. You have you have your bowl and you just grab the communal stew pot. And, you know, the clan stew pot, or that in places like Cahokia, there is like four or five houses where, you know, Cahokia is a very large urban society that was on the Mississippi Valley from about 1000 to 1400 AD. And, you know, we have quite good archaeological evidence there. There's these sort of clusters of houses that are presumably family groups, like extended families. And there's a big fire pit in the middle, and probably various women are tending it, and people are eating whatever they want to eat. And this is exactly what the English found when they came, you know, to North America in 1620 with the with the Mayflower. They found a whole bunch of Algonquian speaking societies, clusters of affiliated villages, and in these villages there would be several cook fires for, you know, extended families, and there'd be these big pots with stew, you know, venison stew with corn and stuff like that and other roots and so forth cooking in it, and people would have their own bowls and they would eat whenever they wanted to eat. And the English did not think this was weird. Basically, you know, once you got out of the city and once you got out of the castles and so forth, you had houses that were not that, in situations that were not that different from the Algonquians. People cooked outside because it was dangerous to cook inside during the summer. In the winter, you cooked inside for obvious reasons.
And the fire was also your heat.
And the fire was also your heat, which is really, yeah. And that was the same thing also for the Algonquians. They would move it all indoors. They didn't have nails, so that, you know, everything was made out of lashed together wood, which is what the Algonquians made their houses out of. There's a central fireplace, and you cooked and heated in the same place. There's beds along the wall and so forth. So that was the way. And you went to China, and China fuel is much less common, so people are much more economical with the fuel, and they have these fire pits, but their houses are much better insulated.
Right. And that's why Chinese food typically is like all chopped up into tiny little pieces,
right,
and cooked very fast,
right,
in a wok. Because
you don't want to use
You don't want to use up the precious fuel as much.
Absolutely. In Japan, where there's slightly more wood, you have the irori, which is a, you know, a raised central fireplace.
So essentially what you start with, first you're outside, then you develop these in various different cultures.
Yeah.
You have a central fire.
Right.
That's kind of, for most people who are not kings or whatever, is in the main room.
Right. It is a space like that. And so wealthy people, like, you know, people in castles, like the Tower of London. You go to the Tower of London and there's all these, you know, places where the king would, you know, receive people. And then all the way across this big courtyard is the kitchens where the big feasts first day. And it's hidden away so that visitors don't sully their eyes this, you know.
And there's smells
and smoke and dirty stuff. And exactly. It's, you know, right next to the space with the lawnmower, so to speak. Right. So that's a very different attitude towards it, in the sense that there aren't these gatherings, there aren't kitchens, they aren't preparing, you know, food in a public way. It's completely the opposite of what we have now.
So we call this episode cooking dinner.
Right.
And the implication is kind of that the family is involved. What is the connection? What gives us the idea of family dinner?
It particularly starts to come up with family farms, which themselves are a relatively new invention because people have, you know, shared responsibilities. And particularly when the, you know, a certain number of members of the family are going out and working in the family farm and are away from the home for, you know, and come back in at lunch.
So I grew up in the South.
Yeah.
And that what you're describing would have been called, where I'm from,
yeah,
dinner.
Right.
Because it's the big meal of the day. And one thing I learned from reading like 19th century literature, American literature, or somebody like Willa Cather, who is writing in the 20th century, mm-hmm, but about the late 19th century, is that midday meal, when everybody comes in from the fields, usually after having a small breakfast,
right,
depending on how affluent they were, but is this giant meal, and they called it dinner, just like we did in the South. Mm. And when I was growing up, we had three meals in the day, breakfast, lunch, and supper. And whichever one was the big meal was dinner. And so in the 1960s and 70s, what that meant, and I suspect this is still true, is that most days of the week, dinner was supper. Supper was dinner. Sundays, lunch was dinner.
This happens, absolutely. But it's, again, it's not a universal pattern because it partly depends on the kind of farm
right.
that you have. So, you know, most American farms by the late 19th century, last half of the 19th century, are like, it's a wheat farm. You know, maybe it has a truck garden or something like that, but it's a single commodity farm that single commodity dictates the patterns of the days. Now, what you have in many other places in the world are these polycultural type farms, and you'll have that in, you know, South America. You'll have that in all kinds of indigenous.
This is subsistence farming versus farming for markets.
For market, and so farming for subsistence is very, very different from farming for the market. And so you get different patterns of what people are doing out there. And commodity type farming, the kind that we're talking, you know, in, you know, the kind of thing that people label industrial monoculture and, you know, all that, has this part where people will spend hours and hours and hours in a particular field doing a particular task, and the whole family, except for, you know, the kids and everything, except for the mom who's, you know, staying home cooking for dinner, will be working at this, and they'll all come back, including the hired hands, and have, you know, supper. This also changes during industrialization, because there, you know, dad is going away to work, maybe the kids are too, but they're not typically coming back for lunch.
Right, right.
So they're carrying a lunch pail or something like that. And then they come back from work, they're hungry, and everybody eats at the same time. So this is when you start getting the, you know, the family dinner, they were right, the family part, when your schedule is more uniform and being dictated in this way. And the switch from supper being at lunchtime.
No, lunch is at lunch.
Supper
is in the evening.
Excuse me, I said that wrong. Because I'm from the North and I'm a barbarian. Sorry.
You haven't read as much Will Cather as I have.
Yeah. It's from dinner being at lunch to dinner being at supper is partly, you know, and controlled by, you know, more and more people working 9-to-5 jobs and coming home. Honey, I'm home. You
right.
Know,
hi, honey, I'm home. Well, like right, those, yeah. And going back to the black and white sitcoms.
Right, right.
When do you start to get, not necessarily a kitchen you would show off, but the idea of a kitchen as a separate room and the stove as
in the house?
A separate room in the house, unless maybe very rich, but yeah. For a typical. When do you get the idea of the kitchen as a separate room in the house with a stove?
Right.
That's not a fireplace, but an actual stove.
Right.
And
not just some open area that you're hanging.
Right.
So, of course, this, you know, the temptation is to make a joke and say this happened in 1827 on July 3rd, you know, but obviously this is a transition that takes place over a while. But you can encapsulate, you know, that transition. And I happen to be able to do this in a personal way. and the reason is that, you know, confession, I'm like this Uber wasp. Okay. I literally have ancestors on both sides of the family that were in the Mayflower.
Okay.
Yeah. No, like all those organizations, I could belong to them if I wasn't so lazy. Right. And when I was a young adult, I went to see Plymouth Plantation, which is the Mayflower Societies or whatever replica of Plymouth, which was the original English colony that was set up by the Mayflower.
Right.
And I was quite surprised to see that one of the houses, which had a docent in it, is supposed to be my ancestor's house. And I don't think it's an exact replica because, you know, they have records, but because my ancestors were actually the reprobates of Plymouth Colony.
And no wonder you're confessing.
Yeah. They were drunks and, you know, they got in trouble. And in fact, one of them was supposedly the first European hanged in North America for murder. And so, serious reprobates. But anyway, and I think they just wanted to tell the story. There's a terrific book by William Bradford, the colony's governor, called Of Plymouth Plantation. And if you took out all the parts where he complains about my ancestors, the Billingtons, the book would be significantly shorter.
So they put the Billingtons. The Billingtons' house, and so because they're such interesting rogues.
They're rogues, right. But I think the house is typical. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And if you go there, the house is no longer in the middle, but it is right on the side. And it's this giant, imposing stone fireplace with a stone. And then the rest of it is a regular thing that's not that different from the Algonquian house. It's kind of these lashed together timbers. There's a little loft and so forth. There's beds around the side. And then but it's providing heat and cooking. There's all these, pots over it. Now, my ancestors didn't do that great in the New World. There's lots of us who did well. They are not among them. But finally, after 300 years, some of them married well, married into a German shipping family. And my great-great-grandfather finally, built the big house. It's a very American thing. You make some money and you build a big house. Look at Tom Brady. He built a castle, right? With 100 bathrooms or whatever he has. And so he does this on the Connecticut shore. And my grandparents inherited the house. And so when I was a kid, I visited there. And there was this completely sealed off dining room and with, family portraits around there. And my grandmother would sit at the head of the table, my grandfather on the other side of the table. My grandmother had a little bell. And she would ring the bell, and this woman, Anne, would come in, who was dressed entirely in black, maybe with a little lace here and there, like a Bunraku puppet person,
Notice her.
Yeah, don't notice her. Right. It's all, and she'd come in silently with this tray, and we'd provide food, and it would go. That kitchen was in the house, and it was not tiny, but it was hidden. It was still hidden away. And the key thing is, it had a stove, and the original stove, I feel quite sure, because it was built in the 1890s, was not gas, but was coal.
Coal, yeah.
And coal was a big invention, because you no longer had to have giant piles of wood with that, although they did have fireplaces, so they did actually have giant piles of wood. But you didn't have to do it for cook. Instead, you'd get a delivery from, and it would go in the coal scuttle underneath the house, and you would put it up. And so there was the beginning of cooking appliances.
Right.
It was still dirty and still something that was hidden away, but it was seen as better to be in the house.
Right. And it changes how you cook, which we're not going to go into great detail, but you need to redesign the pans and all of that stuff because you're cooking on something
a flat surface,
and you're not in danger as much of reaching your arm over a fire or getting your skirt caught in the fire. By today's standards, we would not consider these stoves safe, but compared to the open fireplaces, they were much safer.
I mean, at least in colonial America, a significant percentage of people were drunk all the time.
Yeah.
And this is, partly because that was social customs and partly because the water wasn't good. And so people were drinking alcoholic cider and beer and so forth. So home fires set off by kitchen, that's like a common thing. And if you read old colonial newspapers, so-and-so's house burned down because the kitchen fire was
right.
This all, it doesn't vanish, but it dramatically improves. So the point that I think you're making is that progress, happens in the most real, fewer people burn to death.
Right.
But, coal fire in the house, still not great.
Yeah. And there was an objection that food cooked on coal didn't taste as good. And I've read that this is true, and I can certainly believe it.
It is true. I mean, there are all these gases that come. And in fact, there's a whole movement, now today in our decadent period, to go back to wood fires. And it's not just pizzas.
Early 20th century, there are coal stoves. Early 20th century, depending on where you are, you might also have a gas stove or a electric stove. Yeah. But the point is, the kitchen is a separate room.
Right.
And you eat ideally in the dining room.
Right.
But that starts to change. And the other thing is so I wrote this book, The Power of Glamour.
Right.
We'll talk about some of the themes of that in a minute. But one of the things I had to do in researching that book was watch a lot of old movies and read books about set design.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that you see in that period is the evolution of what is called at the time the modern kitchen.
Right. The sort of aspirational kitchen.
Right. And what is a modern kitchen? It's a kitchen with cabinets. That's right. A big part of it. Because before this, you would have just had open right. shelves on the wall. It's a kitchen with where the countertops and everything are the same level.
Right.
And you don't see the pipes under the sink.
Right.
It's somehow either closed in with the cabinets or at least a curtain. And it has modern appliances. If you're in the 20s and 30s, you know, you're starting to talk about people owning refrigerators right. as opposed to ice boxes. But there's also, this is the period of the Bauhaus and yeah. time and motion right. studies for industry. And you have Lillian Gilbreth, who is the mother in Cheaper by the Dozen, and her husband is a efficiency engineer,
right.
and she tries to take some of those things and apply them.
Right.
To,
so there's this source of the humor in the book Cheaper by the Dozen is mom applying efficiency to the family home.
Right, right. Right. You know, how to take an efficient shower and that sort of thing. Yeah. Out of this comes something that I know your wife is an architect and a builder, and we've talked about is the triangle.
Right, right. So there's this, this is one of these things that the instant I say it, if you don't know what it is, you go, oh, that makes sense. It's like one of these obvious things that until you know the name. And so there's No, it didn't used to exist, but it's the idea that every kitchen has a sink, a refrigerator, and a stove. And what you're doing when you're cooking is moving back and forth between them. And it's just way easier if the triangle is not, you know, something huge, but they're reasonably close together. What you want is the triangle, all the parts of it to be in with what's called the comfort zone, which is the distance that you can reach without having to take comfortably without having to take a whole bunch of steps. And kitchens that you do that have a good triangle with, you know, the pieces in a comfort zone are just way easier and more efficient to cook in. And so there is this idea in it, these time and motion studies where there's ones that you were talking about, and then this was all redone in the 1990s with even more this in RISD, show that actually
that's the Rhode Island School of Design.
The Rhode Island School of Design, this famous design school, show that actually when people, typically women, but just people, cook dinner, there's something like 400 different, typically 400 different motions, meaning that something where you have to shift position and go over there. And in poorly designed kitchens, it means the person is walking a quarter mile sometimes or a half a mile just to cook dinner, which is insane. So there's this idea that we can fix things and make them better, which comes in and is really important, but it takes place very slowly. So your kitchen here is a galley kitchen.
Right. It's a galley kitchen.
Now, we should explain what a galley kitchen is.
Yeah. So a galley kitchen, I always think of them as the kitchens that if you're watching HGTV, some House Hunter shows, the American.
The before.
And sometimes it's the before where they're going to redo the kitchen. And sometimes it's the Americans looking in some other country. And sometimes it's just people house hunting who have a limited budget. And they go in the galley kitchen. And they go, oh, this kitchen is so small. Oh, where is the island? I don't like it. Blah, blah, blah. And that's the kind of kitchen I have. It's I love my kitchen, by the way, but it is, it's one long corridor.
Right.
And on one side, there's a pantry and the refrigerator. And then there's a little breakfast nook.
Yeah.
And then on the other side is the dishwasher, the sink, a little bit of counter, the stove, the range and the ovens are all one piece. And then some more, sort of what I think of as like the baking department, but there's more counter space and cabinets. And it does have the triangle.
You know, Virginia is foreshadowing something that we're going to be talking about. Virginia's kitchen is actually super efficient because the triangle, you know, I've been in it and you just have to reach this or, and, you know, to go from one part to the next, but it's not glamorous.
Right.
It's not what you want on HGTV because it's part of this process by which this previously hidden part of the house is gradually coming out and flipping out and becoming featured part of the house.
And the other thing
and
is,
yours is a mid-transition.
Right. It is a transitional, in historical terms, it is a transitional kitchen because it also can be closed off.
Right.
When we redid it, we got rid of one door, but there is a pocket door between the kitchen and the dining room. And
right.
there is a separate dining room. There is this little breakfast nook where you could eat, you know, a family of four could comfortably eat. But there is a dining room, a quite spacious dining room.
Right.
But unlike the dining rooms of my childhood, the dining room is open to the living room.
Right.
It's all one.
Again, that's also transitional because the dining room and the living room are beginning to morph together.
Right. So you're beginning to get the great room, which is almost like a reinvention of an early modern.
It's getting closer because I mentioned my wife, Ray, and I, she's an architect and builder, and we own a small design and construction company. And, you know, build houses and this sort of thing. And our house, the one that she built for us in 2012, also has a galley kitchen, but it's open to the living room.
Ah,
right,
yes.
Right. It's part of this transition where there's a great room, so to speak, because there is a dining area, but it's all part of one space. And so what we've done with this, you know, high-tech kitchen of ours is reproduce the house of the Billingtons, right? In which kitchen over here, and there's this, you know, grand space. So we've completely flipped it around, and the feature that has been hidden is now, you know, people congregate around it. And the other thing is, there's a name that we need to mention, who is Julia Child.
Oh, yes.
Julia Child is a remarkably important figure in American cultural history. And to give you some idea, she's not a name that's famous now because she's, you know, as famous
well,
now.
Well, but there have been a movie and a TV series about her.
Julia Child is published by Knopf, my publisher. And 20 years ago, there was the 100th anniversary of Knopf. And, you know, the publisher is very proud and they invite all the Nobel Prize winners and so forth. And there's this question, who is the person to address a whole room of rampaging egomaniacs? And, you know, who will all feel terribly slighted if they aren't that person?
Ah.
And it was Julia Child. And there was, you know, Salman Rushdie was there. There's no grumbling because they all recognize Julia Child was more important than them.
So how did Julia Child introduces French cooking to American housewives via a TV show.
Via TV.
And cookbooks, hence
cookbook. And provides glamour for cooking, right? And says, you can do this.
Right. So it's not too glamorous because it wasn't like you have to go to a restaurant to do this. It was like, I'm going to teach you how to do it.
And she also is a pioneer in kitchen design. And she goes to the RISD people, and she's their primary consultant.
Ah, interesting.
For all this. And so there's these two people. Jane Langmuir is the primary person, and a guy named Mark Harrison. But Julia Child is like the person they consult. And one of the things that she says that is kind of funny, if Julia Child's kitchen is actually in the Smithsonian. And if you go there, you'll find she doesn't have cabinets. She has open shelves.
Oh, no.
Right.
Back to the past.
Right, right. She takes all this because she's proud of cooking. She had them open because she used everything, you know. And so it's a way of showing off her fantastic copper pots and everything.
Yeah.
But it's also because I use it all so much that it doesn't collect dust. You know, it's like a statement of prowess. It's practically like having, you know, gym equipment invisible in the house.
Yeah.
So she does this and it becomes, you know, this location for the font of home productivity where you are entertaining and bustling around and people are seeing you do this.
Right. So you invite your friends over
into the kitchen,
invite your friends for dinner and part of the experience, maybe the last steps of preparation in the kitchen.
We are typical of this. You know, we invite our friends for dinner. Ho, ho, we're such great cooks. You know, we have this little island and, you know, the guests are on this side of the island and we put out cheese and everything like that while they see us with our copper pots. Because, yes, I have copper pots from France because I'm a yuppie. And, and you know, we're doing this and talking with them and it's all very convivial. But it's also this weird flipping up and back to what we had when the Billingtons were drunk and and carousing in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Yeah.
So we've seen kitchens, or I should say, we've seen the site where you cook dinner has gone from the sort of communal fire or outside to the hearth inside.
Closed off
place where you have something called a stove.
Right.
You start to get people, families eating in the kitchen, but if you have guests over, you eat in the dining room or for a special occasion or whatever. In my family, we always ate in the dining room, but we were weird.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody else, normal
traditional
people,
in a certain
normal
way.
People ate in the kitchen, except for like Thanksgiving or whatever.
Right.
And in this period where the kitchen then becomes an efficiency place.
Yes.
And a designed place. It becomes a place, a site of design.
And a place that people are proud of, that they show off.
Right.
And, you know, you see this all the time in videos today, right? Where both, you know, design pornography, but also, you know, things like trad wives who are, you know, making cupcakes in this improbably pristine space, you know, practically reeking, you know, happiness and glamour, and then the whole family eating together, which of course begins to break down as people watch TV and eat, you know, with their TV dinners.
Right.
And so there's these countervailing forces to this, this image.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we mentioned, there's this attendant moral panic periodically where, why aren't people eating together? The answer is, they are actually the when you have each family member, you know, eating off on their own, you're just going back to the traditional way it was.
So I mentioned earlier that I wrote this book, The Power of Glamour. And the idea of that book is that glamour is a form of visual persuasion.
Right.
And it takes many different forms, but they all create the same sensation and the same that many different forms of comedy, you know, people laugh. You can tell by the reaction. And glamour creates the sensation of projection and longing. If only I had that kitchen, my life would be perfect.
Can I rant for a second?
I guess so. I can't stop you.
you could, but it would be awkward. So a lot of these glamorous kitchens don't work very well as kitchens. They're designed to be photographed, which is a kind of congenital sin with a lot of architecture in general, that things are designed to be photographed in 2D often don't work that well in 3D. And the particular thing that drives me batty is the giant kitchen with the giant island that's, you know, very beautifully made with marble or whatever, that stands between the one element or the other of the triangle. So you have to do this sort of track run around it. And I can't tell you the number of kitchens that I've, you know, visited people, and I say, you know, hey, I'll cook dinner tonight. And then I discover that I'm going around and around this damn island because the sink is here, the refrigerator is here, and the island is in between.
Right. So the triangle was this great early 20th century idea, which I guess part of its origins were when people started to get refrigerators. So you get, but also the ideas of efficiency. And it's very convenient. And it's completely compatible with an island.
Yes.
But if you don't design it
right,
if you forget about that, and this is another thing about glamour, is glamour always leaves things out.
Right.
So a lot of kitchen design, and certainly the way houses are staged when they're for sale or if somebody is flipping a house, is designed to create that sense of projection and longing. If I had that kitchen, I would have great family dinners. We would gather around I would have friends over. We would gather around the island.
And you wouldn't be, because it's open.
You wouldn't be isolated.
Right.
And sometimes it's more practical, like I'll be mom and I'll be making dinner and I can look at the kids playing. But a lot of times it's this idea of entertaining and having friends over and this conviviality. And then the people buy the house with a glamorous kitchen, and they order their meals from DoorDash and eat them on trays in front of their video where
names,
they watch.
But there are people I know very well who are who you have described exactly.
Thank you for joining us for Everyday Abundance. This podcast is sponsored by the Abundance Institute, and you can find all the episodes and show notes on their website at abundance.institute. Very easy to remember. Also easy to remember is our YouTube channel, Everyday-Abundance. Please subscribe. You can also find episodes wherever you get podcasts. Our producer is Toby Murashanu, and the music was written and performed by John Harden.
If you like this and want to support us, the most important thing you can do is actually leave a review. And this matters in ways that the gods of the algorithm are best able to explain.